We'll call the business and the interim committee on business and labor to order. And welcome everyone. And our first item of business is an informational meeting on injured workers' access to providers in managed care organizations. At this point, we'll call Dr. Vern Sabo and Dr. Ruth Lowengard, please. Please give us your name and affiliation. Let's proceed.
Chair Kittimer, co-chair Garrett, members of the committee, for the record, Dr. Vern Sabo, representing the Oregon Chiropractic Association. In this state, Oregon law states that injured workers get to see the health care provider of their choice, but that's not exactly happening. Currently, we have a lack of health care providers that are willing to even see injured workers. We have an access problem. In fact, MLAC has formed a subcommittee to review that issue and come up with suggestions. In addition to that, we have managed care organizations who have restricted lists of providers that they will allow on their what is known as a panel that can treat injured workers, while at the same time we have a paucity of providers who are willing to prevent or provide chiropractic or medical treatment to injured workers. Chiropractic physicians tend to focus on musculoskeletal injuries, not the least of which are low back injuries, and low back injuries are one of the most common expensive work-related injury in the state, nationally and internationally. And it's of some interest that just last December, the state of Oregon, the evidence-based guidelines development through the Oregon Health Sciences University Center for Evidence-Based Policy and the Health Evidence Review Commission adopted low back pain guidelines. And spinal manipulation is the only non-pharmaceutical intervention that the state of Oregon recommends for an acute episode of low back pain, such as an injury. Well, this is at the same time that Oregon tends to lead the nation in both spinal surgery and in prescription narcotic abuse. We're third in the nation with the latter, both of which chiropractic intervention has been shown to help reduce. Chiropractic physicians currently provide 94% of all spinal manipulation in this country. It's our principal intervention or tool. It's not the only tool in our toolbox. We're very well trained to do so, but what is equally important is that chiropractic physicians tend to be a one-stop shop. We perform our own consultations, examinations, and we perform hands-on treatment. Spinal manipulation is one of the principal treatments. We perform our own physiotherapies. We do not prescribe the meds. We try to prevent happening to do that, and if in fact it's necessary, can refer them to someone who can, such as Dr. Ruth. It's strange to us that the managed care organizations are so restrictive when we have an access problem, and very restrictive to chiropractic physicians whose forte is musculoskeletal injuries and the treatment of things such as low back pains. And I want to give you just a couple examples. I'm just going to give you, for time, the Portland metro area, GSA, Geographic Service Area 4. I currently have 785 chiropractic physicians in the Portland metro area. Caremark Comp has 45 chiropractic physicians, or roughly 5% on their panel for the whole Portland metro area, estimated population of 2.2 Oregonians. Providence, 43, again about 5%, and Oregon Health Systems has 10 chiropractic physicians for the Portland metro area, or 1.2%. And there's other GSAs with similar numbers. And so our point is this makes little sense because there's multiple studies that have shown that chiropractic management not only reduces costs but improves outcomes. And I'll give you just one example that was published in 2007. It was a large study over 70,000 member months, prospective study wherein the patient could select a chiropractic or naturopathic physician to manage their care, or a medical osteopathic physician. They follow them through time for 7 years. In the chiropractic, naturopathic managed group, there was an 85% reduction and drug costs, and a 62% reduction in MRIs and spinal surgeries, a 60.2% reduction in hospital admissions, and a 59% reduction in hospital days with a 95% patient satisfaction rating. Injured workers should be allowed to select a chiropractic physician or a physician of their choice, and so we would recommend respectfully that if, in fact, a chiropractic, medical, osteopathic, naturopathic physician or nurse practitioner goes through standard credentialing, agrees to follow the rules of the managed care organization and the pre-certification requirements, they should be allowed on panel. It makes no sense not to allow those willing providers, of which there's a paucity apparently, on panel so injured workers have ready access. That completes my testimony, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'd be willing to answer any questions now or later if you'd like.
Okay. Shall we proceed with Dr. Lohengard and then we'll have questions, please.
Chairman Kennemer, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Ruth Lohengard. I'm a medical doctor in the practice of occupational medicine and orthopedic medicine in Medford, where I've been for 17 years. I'm a member of the Oregon Medical Association. I'm an arbiter with the State Workers' Compensation Division and a certified independent medical examiner. There is a shortage of physicians willing to treat workers' compensation claimants in Oregon. SAFE, the largest workers' compensation insurer in the state, recently commissioned this study by Blue Research, which I have a copy of. I didn't provide it to you, but it's available. They spent a lot of money finding out why physicians don't want to treat workers' compensation claimants. They found that doctors are unwilling to treat them because it's complicated. They have to deal with legal issues. They have to deal with return-to-work issues. Managed care organizations, in the face of this shortage, are further restricting physicians from their panels. I'm enlisting this committee's support to change the workers' compensation statutes to allow all willing and qualified physicians access to the MCO panels. MCOs were developed to assist insurers in return-to-work issues and medical care issues. When an injured worker is enrolled by the insurer into a managed care organization, they are required to choose only from that panel of doctors and providers. OHS, one of the largest MCOs in the state, has denied me membership three times over 12 years, whereas Providence MCO has, I am a member of. Those are the two MCOs working in Southern Oregon. In the meantime, they have added numerous other providers in the urgent care clinics. If the current statutes state that they only need three providers in an area, as Vern testified, there are only 10 chiropractors on the OHS panel for all of Portland. There are only four doctors and clinics in the Rogue Valley area where I am from who are willing to see occupational medicine workers' comp patients. The two urgent care clinics, Asante and Providence Occupational Health, Valley Immediate Care, and Medford Medical Clinic. I suspect the real reason for denying membership to myself, to two neurosurgeons in Portland who have written to the Management Labor Advisory Committee, and the Ashland orthopedic physicians who have also been denied membership, is that we are the doctors who are willing to advocate for our patients with legitimate injuries. Despite approximately 25 physicians who are listed as attendings in the Rogue Valley area for OHS, there are only the four clinics who are actually willing to see them. Most doctors just don't want to deal with workers' compensation. Most of these are the urgent care facilities, as I mentioned, and only essentially four doctors. If you go to one of the occupational health clinics, you're more likely to see a nurse practitioner or physician. You don't have a choice. You see who's available. In the urgent care facility, really only one physician's assistant at Valley Immediate Care is assigned almost all of the workers' compensation cases because the other doctors in the immediate care clinic don't want to deal with it either. At Medford Medical Clinic, only one physician is doing almost all of the workers' compensation patients, despite the fact there are 10 or 15 other doctors on the list. I'm the only board-certified occupational medicine physician in the Rogue Valley area seeing workers' compensation patients. Many of the injured workers that I treat have complicated, complex medical issues that haven't been addressed by urgent care providers. I am one of the few people who are willing to see claimants with litigated claims. Patients choose to transfer me to me from their urgent care providers because of my reputation for excellent care. Over the last 17 years of practice in Medford, I have seen approximately 500 safe claimants and 1,500 other claimants with other insurance. Since SAFE has now contracted with OHS, they were contracting with Providence, of which I'm a member, I can no longer see any new SAFE claimants. A number of other insurers also use OHS, and I can't see them either. SAFE and other insurance claims examiners have actually disenrolled some of the claimants to allow them to see me because they know that I'm the only provider in the area willing to see some of these complicated claims. For example, one claimant was rolled over by a heister. No doctor south of Portland would see him. He lived on the coast, nobody in Eugene, nobody in on the coast, and nobody in Medford area. Other claimants are similar. Complicated claims that I will see, head injuries, etc., people with multiple injuries that I will see. I'm one of the few physicians in Southern Oregon willing to treat these complicated and complex workers' compensation claimants, but I've been administratively denied by OHS from doing so. And I'm not alone. As I mentioned, there are two physicians on the MLAC website that you can see their letters complaining that they have not been allowed on panel either. Ashland orthopedic physicians were denied over 10 years from becoming on the panel and only recently got access because there was enough outcry from the community that they couldn't see their own local orthopedic physicians. The exclusion of physicians such as us from the MCO panels is creating an even greater access of care for workers' compensation claimants, and especially access of care to compassionate quality care. However, it is not always, OHS will maintain that workers are able to see physicians. They have testimony on the MLAC website stating that it takes only 2 to 3 days to get a worker in to see a doctor. However, it may not be in the best interest of the claimant to stay in the urgent care facility with a doctor who is not interested in pursuing their claim and providing them quality care. The law should be changed so that MCOs cannot deny access of qualified physicians who are licensed and trained and with experience in workers' compensation. In addition, I think a workers' compensation division appeals process, similar to that already in place for injured workers, needs to be developed so that MCO denials and terminations can be reviewed if requested. I recommend this committee consider legislation that will allow all willing and qualified providers access to membership on MCO panels so that workers will have greater access to medical care and compassionate care. I would like to thank you once again for allowing me to testify and on this important issue, and I'll answer any questions.
Great, thank you. Are there questions? Representative Matthews.
Thank you. I'm just trying to sort through this. And Dr. Schnabel, we met last week and appreciate the time that we spent. So Dr. Longart, you had said you were denied 3 times over 12 years?
Yes.
And did they give, when they deny you, do they give you specific instances and why that is? Or
yes, they said we do not have a shortage of physicians. They had no business need for my services.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please, continue.
So they claim there's not a shortage of physicians, but are there cases where people are not being seen where, and I don't know if you can share it, maybe it's patient confidentiality, but are there actual people that are saying, I can't personally get to a doctor, I need to be seen? I know that we're saying, but are there names that we can have, or at least people that can contact you that will come forward that will paint this picture personally?
Well, I have testimony, an affidavit from one of the law firms in the Medford area who tried to find an OHS claimant a doctor. And they called every doctor who was an attending on the list, and they found only those four facilities. So there are four facilities that will see patients, but as I mentioned before, they're all urgent care facilities: Asante in Providence, Occupational Health, Valley Immediate Care, and Medford Medical Clinic. None of the other doctors will see them. So they can find a doctor, but let's say you go to Asante or Providence Occupational Health and you're not satisfied with that care. The doctor says, you're ready to go to work, there's nothing wrong with you. Patient's still in pain, they have a problem, the claim has been accepted for a lumbar strain, they're not getting better. They haven't been referred to a chiropractor, they've been referred to physical therapy, they're not getting better. The doctor says, you go back to work. The claimant says, no, I'm not better, I need another opinion. They can choose doctors, but to go from Asante Occupational Health to Providence Occupational Health is like going from McDonald's to Burger King. It's not a choice. It's not a difference. There's not going to be a different outcome. And so Valley Immediate Care is unfortunately even worse. So there are no other physicians that the patient can refer themselves to who will treat them, other than urgent care facilities. They can't refer themselves to an orthopedic physician, for example, an orthopedic surgeon. Let's say they may have a surgical problem. They can only be referred to an orthopedist by referral. If they go to the orthopedist and they say, you're not a surgical problem, goodbye.
Yeah. Continue.
And I appreciate that. It's all very compelling. I've been a workers' comp individual in a case where I had a complete knee reconstruction. That wasn't the case for me, so I'm just asking, to help us through this.
Right.
Because when we talked, we didn't isolate this to be a rural problem or a metro problem. This is just a problem throughout the state.
This is statewide.
And so I just, to put us in touch with some of those folks that are having that access would be great as we move forward.
So OHS did this study, which I'm sure they'll provide you, that they said that it took 2 to 3 days to get an injured worker into a doctor. And those are, like I said, the urgent care facilities. Now, if you have a litigated claim, let's say your back strain was accepted, but your herniated disc, which happened, the injured worker feels has happened at the same time, nobody is going to see that person because now they have a litigated claim. What's wrong with them is denied. I often deal with litigated claims, whether or not their outcome, they still need treatment. They still are in pain. They're still not able to do the job that they were hired to do, manual labor, whatever it is. No matter what the outcome, they still need treatment, but nobody will see them in that system.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions?
Chair Kittimer, members of the committee, I'd just like to make another comment. I just got another letter from an injured worker, which I can provide May 16th. The other issue that comes up is because of the limited panels, especially with chiropractic physicians, this injured worker was talking about, he was seeing a current chiropractor, was doing quite well, and then was enrolled, said that they can no longer see this chiropractic physician and had to see someone on the panel, and it was no one close to their home, and they would have to travel quite a distance to get to a person on the list. And that really shouldn't be. I mean, it really is not unnecessary.
Yes. I do have one question. I mean, and this might be kind of a naive question, but why are the panels so limited?
Chair Kittimer, Representative Doherty, excuse me. I'm unclear. I have suspicions.
Yeah.
Yes. Of why that may be, but nothing concrete. I don't know why. It makes no sense to us. Maybe the managed care organizations can give you some rationale that makes sense.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
Could I speak to that also?
Please.
In the MD world, the only physicians that are being denied access to the panels are the physicians who are willing to advocate for their workers and patients. Anybody else can get on the panel who wants to. In fact, Providence MCO, we're credentialed through Providence Health Plan. In my independent practice association, Prime Care, credentials everybody. And anybody who's qualified, licensed, reasonable doctor is on the panel. They pay their $25. They get on Providence MCO. With OHS, they do their own credentialing. So they pick and choose who they want. They decide that Dr. Loewengaard is going to be advocating for her worker, for the workers. We don't want her.
My understanding is you have a time set up with IMLAC to talk some more about this topic.
Well, this has been a topic of, Chair Kittleman, members of the committee, this has been a topic of discussion for some time. There's actually a subcommittee on medical access that has been meeting, and the issue of the closed panel managed care organizations has come up, and we'll continue to discuss it.
Okay. And we did present to the IMLAC committee last month.
Okay. We'll look forward to working with you more. Thank you.
Thank you.
No further questions. Thank you very much.
Okay. Let's move on to our next topic, and is the major topic for the day. It's about alcohol retail sales and regulatory structure of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I guess a couple of, maybe it's good to set the stage, if we could, for just a moment about this topic. With the initiative in Washington and the changing environment about alcohol sales there, there was some concern about what implications that might have or not have for Oregon. And there's always a certain amount of unhappiness and a certain amount of happiness about this topic. So it seemed appropriate for us to explore it a bit. And as Representative Garrett and I were talking about it, we thought that we would start today's session with sort of a backgrounder so that we understand how we got to where we are and kind of how that fits in the broader scheme. This is the first in the three segments. Then in the second segment, we will ask those who wish to have changes to come forward and discuss what it is that they would like. And then in the November meeting, we will talk about whether or not some of these might proceed as legislative concepts under the committee or otherwise. So today, to get us started on the historical background and the Oregon liquor control statutes, we've asked Chuck Taylor with Legislative Council to help us. Good morning and welcome. Please give us your name and let's proceed. Good afternoon. Yeah, you know.
Time flies.
Well, time flies when you're having fun. Sorry about that. Thank you. Good correction.
Chairs Kennemer and Garrett, members, good afternoon. I'm Chuck Taylor from Legislative Council. And here to give you a brief history lesson, which is probably the driest thing you will hear this afternoon.
So is that a pun?
It, probably. I'll try to keep it on a somewhat superficial level. Mm-hmm. In the interest of time, I know you have a lot of important testimony to hear, but if there is something you want to go into in more depth,
sure,
we can do that. So starting way back at the beginning, before 1914, alcohol control in Oregon was basically a local matter. The counties and cities had very extensive authority to regulate alcohol within their borders. In 1914 and 1916, the state adopted some constitutional amendments that basically created prohibition. Those were repealed in 1933. However, because they were enacted, they had the practical effect of impliedly repealing the local control in Article 11, Section 2, even though that language was never removed from the state constitution. So if you find yourself looking through the Constitution at some point and come to Article 11, Section 2, you will see language saying that counties and cities can control liquor within their borders, etc. Forget that. It's dead letter. But it's still there. So in 1933, the state had repealed its prohibitions. The federal government was getting ready to repeal it. So the governor appointed a citizens committee draft recommendations on what post-prohibition Oregon should look like. And one thing to understand about the prohibition is that it wasn't really necessarily just a attempt at imposing some type of moral code or anything like that. Pre-prohibition, manufacturers of alcohol tended to control the retail outlets. And it was what we called a tied house setup. And so you would go into a saloon and they would provide you with the products from their manufacturer. And you would have a, on one corner would be the Budweiser Tavern, the next corner would be the Miller Tavern, across the way would be the Pabst Tavern, etc. So they were all competing with each other in a very rough and tumble kind of freewheeling atmosphere that had some very strong social side effects that people weren't too happy with. And that was a large part of what motivated prohibition to begin with. And it's something that when prohibition ended, the committee still had very much in mind, basically trying to avoid a return to that type of a situation. So there was no interest at all in having a return to saloons, which was basically any place where it was primarily a drinking atmosphere. That was regarded as something that would have all sorts of problems. So there were really three primary issues. One was whether beer and wine should be available by the drink, provided that it was properly regulated. They were thinking in terms, for instance, of someone who wishes to go have dinner at their private club, and can they have a glass of wine with their meal, so long as it wasn't a drinking atmosphere. And they worked very hard trying to balance that out. They also had the issue of how to deal with bottle sales of distilled liquor. Distilled liquor by the drink was not considered an option. That was too much of a saloon thing. But there was debate about, do we have distilled liquor available in packages? And if so, how do we do it? And also the concern was how to make sure that we had a system that would not encourage illegal manufacture or sales. So the committee, looking at this issue, basically looked at three systems with regard to distilled liquor. One was to have state-operated liquor stores. The second one was to establish a private corporation, public corporation, excuse me, and basically give them a state monopoly to handle distilled liquor matters. And the third was to simply allow retail outlets to sell any type of liquor that they wanted, regardless of alcohol content. That third option, the retail very quickly got rejected because they were afraid you would see a return to the type of competition that had created problems before prohibition. And the public corporation idea had been tried in Sweden. It worked there, but it had some problems that made it impractical for use here in the U.S. So they were left basically recommending a liquor store system. The governor made that recommendation to the legislature that it adopt the report. The idea of the liquor store being operated by the state was partly to try to get the profit motive out of the liquor industry, with the idea that that would reduce some of the temptation to promote excessive sales of alcohol to people. temperance was very much an issue with them. The OLCC concept, the idea of creating an independent commission, basically was to try to get the state to focus on the public safety aspects of distilled liquor sales rather than the business aspects. There was also a bit of a fiction that if you have an independent commission, the state itself is not really in the liquor business and not associated with the liquor business. It's this independent commission, which is, I guess, a more comforting viewpoint if you want to look at it that way. One of the concerns that was mentioned at the time that they set up the system was that they did not want the state to become dependent on revenue from liquor sales, which was kind of interesting because 5 years later there was an effort to repeal the Oregon Liquor Control Act and reinstate prohibition, and one of the arguments against doing that was, well, we can't afford to lose the income. We're too dependent on it. So it changed very rapidly over just that five-year period. If you ever have the chance to look at the original report in 1933 legislation, by the way, there's some wonderfully colorful language and phrasing and some of that that really conveys some of the flavor of the debate that was going on. So in 1933, they introduced the bill and it provided for state liquor sales through liquor stores. Beer and wine were given, of course, the broader sales and were allowed to be served by the drink under appropriate circumstances. The House voted 50-1 to get rid of the liquor store system and instead have the sales through the groceries and drug stores. The Senate basically balked at that, and that was the one point that they were able to negotiate back in.
What year was that? I'm sorry.
1933.
Okay.
So, 1933, we had the Oregon Liquor Control Act, in large part as we know it today, created with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. A couple of events after that, and I will mention this first one. It may sound strange, I'm mentioning it, but it will become relevant in a bit. In 1945, they did an amendment to the Liquor Control Act to add to the purposes encouraging development of Oregon industry. In 1952, there was an initiative to make liquor available by the drink, and that passed. Prior to that point, if you had wanted to have a mixed drink at your club, what you had to do was go to a liquor store, buy the bottle of liquor, take it to your club, have your bartender mix up your drinks, consume them, and at the end of the night, you took what was left of your bottle and you left. And the one of the ideas of the 1952 Liquor by the Drink Amendment was, okay, we are forcing people to buy bottles that may only want a single drink, and that is somewhat inconsistent with the idea of trying to promote temperance.
It's an argument for everything.
Yes. There are still a couple of references to the 1952 Act, the statutes that enacted that, it was known as the Oregon Distilled Liquor Control Act. All of those statutes are now repealed. What we have has been kind of consolidated and rolled into the Liquor Control Act in Chapter 471. But if you go through our statutes, you will come across still the odd reference to the Oregon Distilled Liquor Control Act. I've been working to try to get those deleted out over the years, but we have not gotten them all removed. In 1985, we had a significant change because brewpub licenses were developed. You remember when I was talking about prohibition that one of the problems was the Tide House, where the manufacturer and the tavern have this connection. Well, obviously, if you have a brewpub, that's present, but it was prohibited under the Oregon Liquor Control Act. So we had to make a special licensing there, and it creates kind of an unusual hybrid creature that a brewpub is a manufacturer with regard to any other retailer, but it's considered a retailer with regard to any other manufacturer. Originally, brewpubs were limited to breweries that were producing less than 10,000 barrels. It is now 200,000 barrels. That got ratcheted up over time. 1999, there was an extensive change in that we consolidated a lot of the licensing. We had before that about 20 categories of licensing. We came down to 7 to try to simplify it. So beyond those changes, a lot of what we enacted in 1933 is still there. The OLCC has very broad power to regulate manufacture, possession, sale, purchase, transportation, importation, and delivery of alcohol. As was mentioned, there's been some speculation about moving, whether there will be some movement to emulate Washington in broadening out the distilled liquor outlets. To date, we still operate under an agency situation. The OLCC in the past has allowed a liquor store agency retail outlet to be located within a grocery store if it is in a rural area where basically a standalone store would not survive and you would otherwise not have any service available to people. And more recently, OLCC has been undertaking a pilot project to explore what some of the issues might be is that they might be encountering with regard to expanding this if it comes about. I'm not sure the rest of what I have is going to be of terrible interest to you. We do currently take in a substantial amount of money. Half of the tax collection on manufacturer of alcohol goes to state and county agencies for drug and alcoholism treatment. The remainder of the money, 50% of the tax and 100% of the net profits from the liquor store sales, slight majority of that goes to the general fund. The rest of it is divided up between cities and counties. And I don't have the figures on just what the economics of that are. If there are other questions I can answer, I'd be happy to.
Okay. Thank you. Questions or comments? Yes, Representative Matthews.
The 50% of the money is collected. What's just a ballpark of what that dollar amount happens to be on an average?
50% of the tax revenue. I'm afraid I don't know what that figure is.
That's fine.
In our next
one. Yes, he'll be in the next one.
I think our next presenter can do that.
Yes. Thank you.
Any other questions, comments? I appreciate you doing this. I think it was a difficult task to simplify that much history, but it's helpful to kind of understand how this has evolved and what some of the forces were. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Our next presenter is Mazen Malik, plays Legislative Revenue.
Chair Conemaugh and members of the committee, for the record, Mazen Malik with Legislative Revenue Office. I know taxation is a very exciting subject that we probably don't need any more enticement with it, but I'll use PowerPoint presentation just to make things a little more palatable. In the Legislative Revenue Office, we have our work areas kind of divided between different tax issues, and I take the portfolio of what they call drinking, gambling, and this, all the sin taxes. And if I could ever find this thing, I'll start it for you. Here you go. So your administrator, committee administrator Teresa asked me to talk about alcoholic taxes in general, so I took the liberty of adding beer and wine to your hard drinks. So let's quickly just go through this. This is what I'm going to talk to you about. It's beer, or they call it cider, all over the place in the statutes, and that's probably the 1930 language. Wine and still spirits, and not to use pun as dry and things that Chuck used, but the balloons here kind of represent kind of party atmosphere.
Not your real man.
So are we celebrating the revenue, or?
I guess we'll see if we have anything to celebrate at the end. But the beer tax rate in general, as Chuck mentioned, also started in 1933. At that time, we had $1 per barrel. And today, and of course, it ratcheted about four times only through time. Today, we have about 1977 was the latest that we've increased that tax. And it is today at 2.6 or $2.60 per barrel. That comes down to about 8.38 cents per gallon. And of course, in beer terms, that's if you want to look at a six pack or a bottle, that translates in about 4.7 cents per six packs. So a 12 ounce bottle is about 0.786 cents. So if you're drinking and you're sipping beer at about the rate of an ounce and a half per sip, that's a big gulp, right? Mm-hmm. You'll be paying about 0.9 cents. That's 10% of a cent. That's what we call a mil. A mil per sip. So on 3/4 ounce of a sip, you'll be paying half a mil. So every time you're doing your duty for the state tax system, think of that. So always we try to compare our taxes, especially because Oregon is a beer state, with the rest of the nation and the different states. And we're about at 45 to 48. That's a tied ranking. However, always the sales tax issue comes into question, and we always ask about where that ranking comes as a sales tax is figured in, and Oregon comes down way at the end, about 50th or the 51st state. Now, just because the beer tax was, we have about about $7 million a year. The way this thing is divided, as was mentioned, the beer tax, 50% immediately goes to the mental health program, and 50% transfers to the OLCC fund. The OLCC fund is divided differently. 56% of that goes to the general fund, 10% to counties, and 34% to cities. However, if you put them all together, it will become 50%, 28, and 28%. Your computer is not doing what I need it to do, but. So, if you look at your history of where the fund that beer comes to, that's what you're looking at. Obviously, there is an increase. And if I so you see, works finally. That's about the $7 million in total. Now, we'll keep all this in relative terms to the per capita consumption, and we will add all this up at the end. Think about this, in 1985, per capita consumption of beer was about 38.4 six-packs per person. We peaked at about 41.5 in 2010. Today, we're about 38.8 six-packs per person per year. That will add up at the end. And if the party atmosphere was for the beer, I don't know what's the water and the wine relationship, but let's not get into that. The wine tax is 67 cents per gallon. This was changed in 83 to add 2 cents to the 65 previous cents, and those 2 cents go to the Wine Institute or the Wine Research Board. The state wine tax, always again, the discussion is where do we rank, as because we are also a wine state, and Oregon ranks right down the middle, about 24 cents. Then that's the excise tax by itself. And if you see places like our neighbors to the south, California, which is also a big tax state, it's a lot lower than we are. Then if you add back again the excise taxes and the sales tax, and you look into where we are, we slide down the order to about 47th. And interestingly enough, if you want to compare us with Washington and California, where they kind of go way up in the ranking than we are, because they do impose these taxes. So if you put all these things together, of course, as I mentioned or showed but didn't mention, that the dessert wine, which is the higher content alcohol wine, is 10 cents above the regular wine. Altogether, they add to about $9 million a year. The wine tax immediately takes 2 cents out of that tax into going to the wine board or wine research, and that's an OSU kind of foundation. The rest of it divides just like the beer tax, at about 50% going to the mental health, but ends up at about 48.5. Then the general fund and the counties and the cities get the same kind of definition.
Chair Garrett has a question.
You said that dessert wine is subject to a higher tax.
Yes.
Is that the only case where we tax alcohol higher based on, is that the only case where we differentiate in a category in terms of the tax rate? Is that based on alcohol rate or what?
Representative, co-chair, that is a time when we do that. This is just because of dessert wine, I guess, has a higher content of alcohol, and therefore that's probably why the reason why we do it.
But in terms of distilled spirits or beer, we don't differentiate based on alcohol content?
No,
we don't. All right, thanks.
So the tax revenue, just to put it in history, and the color Bordeaux here doesn't necessarily have any meaning. To put it back into perspective, remember the per capita consumption of beer. We have the peaked at per capita consumption of about 16.4 bottles per year per person. That's every man, woman, and child, by the way. And 1.2 or 1.3 bottles of dessert wine. So add that to the beer that we've been drinking, and then we will see what the real party atmosphere here.
Like the visual.
Now we talk party. Now we're drinking, right? Now the markup. Distilled liquors or spirits don't have a tax, but they have a markup, and the markup is something that the commission is given the right to put that markup, and it's ORS 471745. Today, the official markup is 106%. Haven't changed for years, but this is in front of you is what we term as the effective markup rate, and that takes out the discounts and so on, and that's what you end up with. And as you could see, it's about that amount, about 104%, 105% or so. At different times, it fluctuates accordingly. So if you look at OLCC sales, that's the picture that you could see. The yellow line is the sales that are dollars, and it's in hundreds of millions. These are what termed to be cases, and those cases don't necessarily all match, but that's the measure. So they're not the same size or the same fluid ounces and so on. But the interesting thing about this is when you have the population numbers and when you have the sales starting to cross the populations. And for us economists, when things starts crossing like that, it's a big deal for some reason. We start finding to why does it cross and what does that mean and how it means. Now, back to the consumption per capita thing. Remember that we've talked about the beer and wine. Now for 2011, add about 8.5 bottles of 750 milliliters. That's your regular bottle or average size. 8.5 per capita for each of us. Then per person, you're talking about, that's how it is, the gallons per capita and the sales per person. And the sales per person become an interesting thing because that means in about 2011, we each paid about 113.6 in OLCC or hard liquor taxes. Now, if you take an average family of four like mine, I would have paid something like $454 in that to the state in general. So if you have been doing your share, the state really thanks you. That the $438 million in total revenue for the OLCC, but remember the OLCC gets its revenue from different places, distilled spirits, also privilege tax, or what we call the beer and wine tax, is at 3%. Now, that divides into different segments of the pie. Remember, the markup, what it means is at a certain time you have a cost of goods. The cost of goods come at about 47% of the total. So this is what they pay for the inventory costs, if you will. The other expenditures, the 15%, that includes all the different expenditures, expenses that the OLCC does. You get your 3% from the privilege tax or the beer and wine, 1% from your licenses, and so on. Your net sales is about 35% of that total. So the formula for distribution is what this 35% actually plus the 3%. So the privilege tax, which is the beer and wine, is divided in this way, where you have your 2 cents going to the wine board immediately, and the balance of the beer and wine tax would 50% of it go to the mental health programs in different capacities, and then the 50% goes to the OLCC fund to be distributed with the rest of the gang, if you will. So the OLCC net revenue, that includes the 50% that comes from the beer and wine, will be divided at 56-10 to county, 56 to the general fund, 10% to the counties by their population, 20 cents to the cities by population, and 14% to the cities by formula. And that formula goes way back to the revenue sharing issues that was between the state and the cities. And that was all kind of put together into one formula for rate of distribution. So just to kind of put things back into perspective, the revenue distribution, after all that gives and takes from the revenue stream, comes to about $178 million per year. That's what is distributed between the different governmental entities, and that's how basically, after all is said and done, how it looks. Obviously, the general fund gets a lion's share of that distribution. Counties get about 8.8%, cities about 29.8%, the wine board gets a small sliver, and the mental health programs get about 4.5%. So, just you look at the final distribution, the distribution by color here, and from this point on, you see this great increase, and most of this increase, although some of it is rate increase, markup and so on, but very slight, a lot of it is population and consumption, and also the what the OLCC says, that moving the consumer to a higher higher value type of drinks and so on. So just to put this in perspective, in the last 10 years, this transfer increased by about 80%. That is a healthy increase. Now, going back and putting all these numbers I gave you per capita consumption together, remember you have about 38.8, that's about 39 six-packs, and 17.6 bottles of wine, 8.5 bottles of hard liquor, and then applying the 4 individuals per family factor, you end up with a healthy amount, about 234 six-packs, 70.4 bottles of wine per year, and 34 bottles of hard liquor. Now, if I want to translate this to my family, I have a family of 4. The kids didn't start drinking, as far as I know. So it's me and my wife. That means I have to have 4 beers a day.
Jeez.
Do your fair share.
Huh? Well, I do my best.
The wine is 1.4 bottles per week.
which means that 5 ounces a day, I think I don't do the wine thing, so I let my wife do that. But then I'd have to do 2.3 ounces per day of hard liquor. Now, that's every day of the year. Otherwise, I'll be feeling guilty that I'm not contributing. So if you haven't been doing your share of that much, that's probably...
That's, I guess,
must be the Oregon way. Just to go slightly to the issue that you have in hand...
Excuse me for a second. Oh, Representative.
No, just let him finish.
Oh, okay.
I'm practically done with the presentation, but I need to say a couple words about the issue that you're trying to research. Obviously, all that drinking is not necessarily performed by all of us. Otherwise, we might not have that good, comprehensive, kind of lucid discussion that we're having today. Obviously, a lot of that happens through different means, either leaks out of the state, which means other people buy it, or it's done through the service and the hospitality industry and so on. And some of that is probably what you would find to be the kind of thing when you look at per capita comparisons between different states. We rank a little high on the per capita consumption. Now, having said that, Washington has a lower rank than we do in the percent of consumption. A lot of fear was what happens after 1183 takes effect, and I think we probably won't lose Oregon consumption or Oregon users or Oregon drinkers. Well, some of the Washington residents who have been buying here or taking or recreating here, drinking here, might have some of the in order to go somewhere else to do something, you need to have a push and a pull forces, if you will, in economic terms. So they're trying to allow them not to have the push, although we continue to have the pull. So they have a lot more choices at the time. And of course, just to mention something quick about the Washington initiative. The Washington initiative is going to happen in two phases. One of them is immediately or coming in June. And if you think about what's going to happen at that time, you have the state markup, 52%. You have 27% licenses and fees, and you have the B&O tax of Washington and operation costs and all the things that are starting to go and will go with the different distributors and so on. Immediately, you might not have that differentiation in price that will pull consumers to go in two different places. March 1st, 2014, those percentages and those taxes will change, will become lower. And at that time, that differentiation in price might take effect. So I'll leave you with that. I'll take your questions if you want.
Okay. Representative Vesquiel.
Yeah, I was just wondering, Mazin, I don't drink at all, so does that mean that it puts a burden on you and your family?
I think somebody has to take the slack.
Is Ted going to take up that slack? Very good.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and as a fellow committee member, I'm willing to do my share. And your share.
Who's drinking my family share? That's the next thing.
Chair Garrett.
Yeah.
Thank you. Mazin, can you just elaborate a bit on how you see the Washington measure in terms of effect on price? You just finished up by talking about changes in 2014. What do you expect to see in terms of the price to the consumer out of the Washington measure?
Well, I think in 2014, unless something is done on the Washington side, the price in Washington will start going down, which will start making it more appealing than the price in Oregon. However, remember that Oregonians are not of the habit of going and shopping in Washington. You know, it's not the shopping pull, if you will. The other, I mean, the inverse is correct, is true. So I think we would start seeing a lot less of the Washingtonians coming to buy here or to take. That's probably what the immediate factor would be. If I had to immediately look into it, I haven't necessarily made any estimation of what kind of effect and elasticity of price that would make. But I think it probably will start at least repulsing those buyers from coming here, and they will stay home rather than come and buy here. I don't think you would run the risk of a lot of Oregonians going to Washington to do it. That's probably not going to happen, because people don't necessarily go for only the convenience factor. I mean, think about the driving and the gas and the so. I mean, so the convenience, you're not developing that, and you're not buying it just because you're shopping there. I mean, you shop here anyhow. So the convenience factor is probably not that worrisome. It is the price factor that we should probably be looking at a lot more.
Other questions, comments? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Interesting.
Our next presentation is comparison of Oregon's regulatory framework with other states, and then some issues on consumption, addiction, crimes, and economic effects. We have Dr. Bill Kerr here, Senior Scientist, Alcohol Research Group. Dr. Kerr, nice to have you here. Please introduce yourself and let's proceed.
Thank you. I'm William Kerr. I'm a senior scientist at the Alcohol Research Group, which is part of the Public Health Institute in Emeryville, California. And, my doctorate is in economics, but I do a lot of research on the epidemiology of alcohol consumption, the health effects related to alcohol drinking, and alcohol policy. And thanks for asking me here today to talk about these important issues. And I did, so you all have the document I provided you with some of the inputs here, or is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So I'll just work through that and talk about some of the issues that were highlighted. We've already covered quite a bit about revenues, so I'll try to go through those more quickly, maybe only highlighting some particular things that might be different in my presentation. So we think about alcohol control in general. In the U.S., there are basically two types, general types of systems. One where the government controls some aspect of the alcohol distribution market. In some states, it's only the wholesale aspect. In other states like Oregon, it's both wholesaling and retailing, or at least controlling the price all the way up to the retail level. Most of the states that do that do it for spirits, and there's five states that also do it for wine. There's no state that does it for beer, though Montgomery County and a few other local in Maryland and a few other local areas also control beer, and many Canadian provinces and Scandinavian countries have government control systems that include beer. The first issue I wanted to mention was this issue of orderly markets. And as was discussed earlier, coming out of Prohibition, one of the big issues that was of concern for the new regulations was this saloon problem, where we had vertical integration, particularly of beer companies, but also, I think, to some extent, spirits, which meant that it was possible to sell beer at temporary low costs that might even be lower than the costs of production that weren't really sustainable for the company, but that could get people into their particular pubs drinking their particular type of beer, and then later you would try to raise those costs. So it's sort of pumping the market, you might think of it as. And that was seen as particularly insidious because alcohol, as you know, is a potentially addictive and certainly even in many cases when it's not addictive, very habit-forming product. So people do get into, you know, though while only a small percentage of the population is actually addicted or dependent on alcohol, many people get into the habit of having particular kinds of beer, wine, or spirits on a regular basis. So that can be manipulated to some extent. And this issue actually is still, while it's been kept pretty much under control in the U.S. through either government control of wholesale or retail or through the three-tier system, which every other state has, up until June 1st when Washington Initiative 1183 eliminates some aspects of it, except for beer in Washington. That really means that there's three levels of actors, the producers, the wholesalers, and the retailers. So all of those would have to coordinate with each other to invoke these temporary low prices or these other kinds of strategies, and that doesn't really seem to happen. But in some other countries, currently the United Kingdom and Australia being good examples, they don't have a three-tier system. Producers can sell directly to retailers, and large retailers, particularly the supermarkets in the UK, Tesco and places like that, and big chains in Australia, I think Woolworths is one of the main ones they talk about, sell really large amounts of beer or wine or spirits very cheaply, often below cost, though both of those countries have extremely high alcohol taxes, higher than almost anywhere in the U.S., or probably higher than anywhere in the U.S. But even with those in place, in some cases, they sell at these low rates, basically to get people into the stores. You know, beer, large amounts of cheap beer bring people in, they buy all kinds of other things, and it's good for their business. I think everybody's familiar with the idea of loss leaders in retailing. And alcohol is something that can definitely be used in that particular way, and that's, I think, an important reason why the three-tier system or government control can be important. In thinking about privatization, which is the discussion that's gone on in Washington with Initiative 1183 and has been highlighted in Virginia, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and a number of other control states recently, it's quite a complicated situation because it's privatization to what? Alcohol is always going to be regulated in a fairly complex fashion. You may have three-tier laws ensuring that the wholesalers are owned separately from producers and retailers, or as is this case in Washington, you may not. That makes a big difference. What are the tax levels going to be? On what basis are they going to be determined? How many retail licenses are going to be allowed? On what basis are those going to be determined? So there's no such thing as to say what's going to happen with privatization. But some partial privatizations have happened in the past, and we do know the effects of those. In general, we would expect privatization to result in higher outlet density, so more places selling spirits per population, greater physical availability, which kind of means that it's sort of easier to get at, I'm not sure exactly what that means, but it sort of some of these aspects I'm mentioning here are involved in that. Longer and later hours of sale, so stores might stay open quite a bit later. I walked by a store, one of your spirit stores in Portland yesterday, that was open till 6 o'clock, and that's where I live. Stores are open till 2 o'clock in the morning, a lot of them. So that's quite a dramatic difference if you move from one to the other, and that these late hours are a concern because you do wonder, why does somebody need to buy a bottle of liquor at 2 o'clock in the morning or 1 o'clock or midnight? And it might be a perfectly legitimate thing to do, but it also might facilitate continued drinking for people who just have happened to run out at about that time. And that's something that you might want to prevent. Also, once you privatize, you're engendering a number of different commercial economic interests who have a there's value to them in encouraging consumption, that's going to increase marketing and other kinds of activities that the state might not have engaged in. recently, the CDC's community guide to alcohol policies has recommended against privatizations for states that are considering that. And the reasons for that that they highlight are that there's likely to be increased sales to underage and intoxicated patrons, and those increased sales are well known to increase all kinds of alcohol-related problems, from crime to suicides to alcohol-related mortalities of different types, from the liver, from cancers, and other kinds of things. And that's a cost to not only to sort of society in a general way, but specifically to healthcare systems, police, social work, and other things that the state actually does pay for. We know the control states on average have fewer spirit stores, close them earlier, often have fewer days, though that's not always the case. I wanted to highlight a recent economic study in Pennsylvania, which was kind of interesting, that thought about the state has a monopoly on spirit sales. If it was an actual private monopoly, would there be more stores or fewer stores? And what they found was that the state actually has many more stores than a private monopoly would have, and they locate them in places that are convenient to their population, thinking about access as well as control. So there's not a huge number of stores, but they distribute them around the state in ways that a private monopoly or a private competitive market would tend to concentrate most of the stores around population centers. So you would have a lot of access for some people and a lot less access for others. So, yeah, population density. Yeah, another issue that comes up, I mean, this may be less relevant in Oregon because the state spirit stores are already privately franchised, but some studies have found that the state retail store workers have done a better job with compliance with minimum age restrictions, not selling to underage. And that's certainly something that any store can do, but there may be, particularly if you're getting spirits into grocery stores, convenience stores, other sorts of places where you might have younger employees selling, that can be a big concern. And also, the more stores there are, the more difficult it is for the people that are trying to monitor whether they're selling to underage patrons to keep up with that issue. So that's an important consideration. Yeah. So, just in general, when we think about privatization, the increased availability is the main thing that from public health perspective is of concern, and that's known to be higher outlet density and other aspects like later hours and so forth are known to be associated with more sales and harms. And that literature, while not necessarily specific to privatizations, is quite extensive and fairly clear. The issue with prices and taxes is somewhat more complicated. I mean, alcohol taxes have historically been a major source of revenue for governments, and in fact, before the income tax, alcohol taxes and other similar types of taxes, as well as import-export, were the main funding for our U.S. government. But now that's not so much the case. We have broad-based taxes like income taxes and sales taxes and so forth that are make up more of the main revenues in most places. And alcohol taxes are often thought of as a measure to control alcohol consumption rather than a source of revenue, at least in academic discussions. And there we would think about you'd want to tax the alcohol itself, because we know that has significant costs to society. If you want to discourage drinking through a tax, you would say, like the federal tax on spirits taxes the actual ethanol. So there's a dollar, I think it's $27 per ethanol gallon, so that a weaker strength would attract a lower tax than a higher strength. Typically, state alcohol taxes are on a per gallon basis. So it's the same tax on a gallon of beer, whether it's 3.5% light beer, 5% regular beer, or 8% malt liquor. And that's similarly true of wine, that the, you know, between 7 and 14%, it attracts the same tax, though often above 14%, there'll be a different rate. And even for spirits, which might range from 20% alcohol all the way up to 95% with something like Everclear, I think they call it, or something like that. And in some cases, those attract the same tax as each other, which from some perspectives, doesn't make sense. We know that people do respond to taxes by drinking less. A 10% increase in price is expected to reduce consumption by about 5% on average. Now, that can affect different people differently and in different situations, that there may be a variety of different effects. You can't ever know exactly what's going to happen, but that's sort of the average over many, many studies in the literature. So despite what we know about the effectiveness of alcohol taxes and their importance for public health, in general, taxes are never raised or implemented for those purposes. They really seem to be mainly related to revenue raising, and discussions of them seem to focus on revenue as we have so far here today. And, you know, that's because they can raise quite a substantial amount of revenue in some cases. And I think relevant to some of the discussion earlier about the amount of tax that each person pays or the amount that any particular individual might pay, it's important to remember that from surveys and other types of research, we know that alcohol consumption is highly concentrated. About 10% of drinkers, not even including non-drinkers, drink about 50% of the alcohol that's consumed. There's many, many drinkers who drink very little, just occasionally have a drink here or there, and then the curve goes up and up and up, and there's a particular concentrated number who are drinking 10, 15 drinks a day. Many of them would be alcoholics. They're not necessarily alcoholics. They maybe haven't been doing it for long enough or having enough problems to be considered that, but it's important that both the harms that come from alcohol and the revenues that come from alcohol aren't evenly distributed in the population, and often it is the people that are drinking the most that end up actually paying the most. And there's different ways of looking at it. In some ways, that's maybe the way it should be, because we want to discourage their consumption and they should pay for the problems that they're causing. In another way, if it's a general fund tax, why should they be paying for it and not somebody else? Let's see. And it's whether those people that drink the most respond differentially isn't entirely clear at this point. There's some research has found that they respond just as much or more than other people. Other research has found that they don't respond as much. And I think people have a lot of different opinions on whether these heavy drinkers really are going to be influenced by price or not. In some ways, they're quite resistant to those influences. They drink how they want to drink. That's what they want to do every day. But in other ways, they're the ones that are likely to be income constrained. If they're drinking that much, and they can only have so much money, if the price goes up, they're going to have to drink a little less because they simply don't have the resources to get it. So I think both of those things probably happen in different proportions. An important aspect that's relevant to that is what we call, from the economics literature, quality substitution, or thinking about the different levels of price or quality in, say, the spirits market. I looked on the OCLC website at the prices of spirits, and the cheapest 1.75-liter bottle of vodka, that's sort of the standard cheap drink that we look for, was $15, which is pretty cheap. I mean, I think that's about 35, 40 cents per drink. In California, that bottle would be $10, which is only 25 cents per drink, which is extremely cheap. And everything else goes up from that. You can easily, for vodka, pay $5 per drink. You can buy a $40, $50, $60 bottle of vodka. You can buy a $100 bottle of whiskey. Wine goes, you know, even more up. So there's a wide spectrum within which people can drink. And the main reason, I think, for the skyrocketing, I thought, revenues from spirits in Oregon over the last 10 years, a lot of that has been quality upgrading. And that's not just in Oregon. It's true all across the country and, in fact, in many countries around the world that people are buying.
Maybe you could add a question.
Yeah, you said something a second ago I wanted to follow up on that regarding the comparison, the price of vodka, Oregon and California. We've heard testimony in a previous meeting from somebody from the OLCC saying that based on their research, generally Oregon's prices are better. It's just that in certain loss leaders like that low-end vodka,
that's
California
example,
has lower pricing. Is that your experience as well?
I would say that example I gave is an example of that. I mean, typically I see, when I look for what's the cheapest, you'll find it at one of these drugstores, and it's a different brand, and it's not really necessarily maintained for that brand. So you can always find something like that. So it is relevant, but it's not true that those brands are always $10 and the ones in Oregon are always $15. I think the prices are a little lower in California. We have pretty low taxes and a very high level of competition, but they're not that much lower.
Is it possible to make any generalizations about how privatization versus control states affect price?
It's difficult because you would have to specify what the tax that would be that would replace the control system markups, and you would have to think about what's the structure of the market going to be, how many licenses are going to be allowed, is there still going to be a three-tier system, what are the aspects of that, can wholesalers only, there's a lot of aspects of the three tier that affect competition, like whether a wholesaler can leave or a producer can pull their brands and move them to another one or something like that. So it's very complicated. But in general, if there weren't any taxes, you would certainly expect prices to go down. For an equivalent level of revenue, you would expect prices to go way up, like I would expect them to do in Washington, based on the system that they've put in place.
So you expect prices to go up in Washington?
Yeah,
our economist just told us he thinks they're going to go down.
Well, it's certainly not clear what's going to happen, and we'll see soon enough what the case is going to be. And it's particularly because, for one thing, we don't know how producers will respond. Producers don't necessarily charge every state the same price for the product to begin with. We don't know how the distribution will occur. Wholesalers can mark up a particular product different amounts, and In Washington now, they're not going to necessarily have to have a wholesaler, so they can go directly from the producer. It's not clear whether that'll happen, but if it does, that could bring some of the markups down.
Just on that point, too, as a researcher, how long do you think we need to wait to see what the effects will be in Washington after the law is implemented?
Yeah, that's a good question, because it may take a while for some of these things to play out. Not all the retail and wholesale players may be in place initially, so that would tend to argue for maybe higher prices, because if there's not competition driving them down. Certainly, the tax system that's in Initiative 1183 was meant to make up all of the revenues for a particular bottle that were brought in by the control system. And those were substantial revenues. They were the most of any control system. So that's the particular thing that's likely to push them up the most. And those, and in some cases, if you're putting some of the taxes on at, like the federal taxes are on sort of at the producer importer level, the state taxes tend to be at the wholesaler level. In Washington, some of them are at the wholesaler and some of them are at the retailer level. And that matters because as things move through the system, each tier is going to mark up often based on price. So if there's a tax at the wholesale level, that's going to get passed through, and that'll in turn potentially get marked up at the retail level. But in reality, they can do whatever they want. They can do different things on different products. It seems like it would be difficult for prices to go down and for people to make the kind of money that they're going to want to make to me. But in the long run, who knows?
For the question.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions at this point?
Yeah.
I guess in Oregon we have a fairly substantial tax, or
equivalent tax on still spirits. And yet, if I was looking at your statistics correctly, consumption is above average.
Yes.
Well, and I guess it brings up an interesting question. And of course, we also have the anomaly of beer being so lowly, is so modestly taxed. Mm-hmm.
That was what you call a faux pas, wasn't it?
It's always tough to make these kinds of comparisons.
Well, no, but my point is that I wonder, as a social strategy, how effective taxation on booze is. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem to me that the data necessarily validates that it's a very success. It seems to suggest that it's probably not, unless it's done in some very extreme form, not a very successful strategy.
Yeah, it's a difficult question. I mean, the research clearly shows that changes in taxes seem to reduce consumption, all else held equal, which, you know, in reality, all else isn't held
equal. Isn't it?
And it is true also that when we look at very high tax places like Canada and some foreign countries, they still seem to keep drinking despite taxes that would seem incredibly high by American standards. So people can sort of adjust to a particular situation. But that doesn't mean that on the margin those prices still don't have an effect.
Yes, Representative Hoyle.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there data that shows what the impact is on deterring problem drinking dependent on age? For instance, do higher taxes on alcohol prevent more underage drinking or younger people from drinking?
Right. There definitely is evidence that they're effective on younger people. I don't think it's entirely clear whether they're more effective than they are for older. There's some reason to believe that they could be more effective on younger people because they tend to have lower incomes or maybe not any income at all. So that's something. I mean, but again, you wouldn't. It's not easy to affect them. They're certainly going to try to get around it. But the fact is, if you're income constrained, prices can have important effects. So it's, preventing underage drinkers from getting a hold of alcohol is probably more important. But it might be easier to implement the tax aspect. So yeah, I think that is an important aspect. I go on. What was I talking about? Okay, quality. Yeah, right. The quality issue. Yeah, it's an important one relative to the response to taxes and prices, because particularly in a situation like now, when we've had quite a bit of quality upgrading already occurring, people are drinking better quality beers, wines, and spirits in Oregon and in the U.S. in general than they ever have before. But that also means that they can shift down on a much larger scale than they could before. A lot fewer people are drinking the cheapest versions of any of those products. So that when the recession hit in 2008 and 2009, we definitely heard industry reports of popular level beers becoming more popular again after declining for years and years and years, of the lower priced segments of the wine market doing better than higher priced, which in other years had been the opposite. And I think it's already turned around. There was only about a couple of years of that dropping back. But it shows that in a market like that, there's more flexibility to respond to price, not just through quantity, but also through this quality, and especially actually through context substitution. I mean, there's all these different price levels for brands within off-premise sales, but really the biggest difference in price is between going to a bar or restaurant and drinking at home. So that's another way that people can respond to prices that don't necessarily end up in them drinking less, and that's drinking at home instead of drinking at a bar or restaurant. And then quite a bit of that apparently occurred during the recession also. And So those are definitely things to think about. But with the markup that is the way that revenue is raised on spirits in Oregon, this quality upgrading generates quite a bit of money. So studies of actual privatizations, and it's interesting because there really haven't been This Washington case is especially interesting to researchers because there's never in the U.S. been a full privatization of this type occurring before. There's been a number of states that have privatized their retail tier, so they have kept their wholesale, kept control of the wholesale market, but allow private stores of all different types to sell spirits. This occurred in West Virginia and Iowa, or a couple of cases, and there have been some Canadian provinces that have done this recently as well. And in general, consumption of the controlled beverage that's become privatized goes up. In some cases, overall consumption is found to go up. In other cases, it wasn't so clear, particularly because some of them were only privatizations of wine, and they were in states that really didn't drink that much wine. It was only maybe 10% of the total volume. So that it didn't seem to have a huge overall effect. But if it's spirits that's privatized, it probably would be expected to increase consumption. In some cases, like in the Alberta privatization, because they kept the wholesale control and they charged pretty high prices, prices ended up going up there, but availability went up quite a bit. So they found that they raised a lot less money and had a lot more alcohol-related problems, including a study that showed an increased suicide rates following the privatization. So, you know, that's something to think about. And the most recent evidence has been from sort of an ongoing privatization in British Columbia, where the government has kept their government stores selling spirits, wine, and beer, so they control all three, but they've also allowed private stores, and they sell to those private stores at about 15% less than the price at the government store. So basically, the private stores have to charge more than the government store does, but they can be conveniently located, they can stay open, they can sell cold beer, whereas the government stores only sell warm beer. They can sell other things that go along with beer, wine, and spirits that the government stores don't do. So they've sort of kept the prices high, but increased availability in a number of ways, more outlets and more convenience for shoppers. And they found that this, and a couple of studies of this recently have found that this has increased consumption, particularly in areas where more private stores have located, and that alcohol-related mortality has gone up in those areas as well, related to the additional stores. That's sort of clear evidence of actual privatization activities, what's happened and what the results have been. So that's certainly of interest. In the next section, I'm mostly going through sales and revenue figures, and we've seen quite a bit of that already, but in the first table, looking at spirits consumption in Oregon, one, I think, interesting thing we did is put this in terms of how many standard drinks, which is a 1.5-ounce shot of spirits per person, and compare that with other states. In Oregon, we came up with about 164, which is about 20 more than in California, more than in Idaho, and a little bit more than in Washington. So Oregon certainly, relative to other states, seems to prefer spirits. And we talked earlier about making these direct comparisons, which can be difficult, but in general, we do find that certain states have different preferences for beer, wine, and spirits, so I think it may be that rather than anything about the control system per se. We also find that the heaviest drinking states are in New England and the northern Midwest, whereas the Pacific and Mid-Atlantic states are sort of in the middle, and the southern Bible Belt and surrounding states are the lowest. Mm-hmm. So regardless of alcohol control systems, which vary in each of those regions, we do see some differentiation in drinking styles. And certainly in some of the colder, more northern places, there seems to be heavier drinking per se. For wine, Oregon is also above average, but above average kind of in line with other western states, which are above average, particularly wine-producing states like California and Washington drink more wine per person than Oregon, so they're, Oregon is especially high. in that way, and wine generally sells quite a bit less. Even in the states that drink the most, it's never anywhere near the main beverage type. Usually half the drinking is beer, as it is in Oregon. And finally, for beer, Oregon is almost exactly in line with the national average, either for open or control states, about 250 standard drinks per population age 15 and older, which is kind of the international standard for alcohol comparisons. That's the legal drinking age in a lot of countries, though in the U.S. it seems young. Turning to survey-based measures, I looked at a couple of the major U.S. surveys that assess alcohol consumption. In terms of the CDC's behavioral risk factor survey, they found that in 2010, about 14% of the population in Oregon binge drank in the last month, meaning five or more drinks for men and four or more for women in a day. And 6.2% exceeded guidelines, meaning an average of two drinks a day for men and one drink a day for women, so 60 a month or 30 a month. So a fairly small percentage, but not, and those are sort of similar to the national percentage, a little bit higher on the guidelines and a little bit lower on the binge. Probably a more accurate survey, the behavioral risk factor greatly underestimates the amount that people drink because it's kind of a health survey and it doesn't really focus on alcohol-related issues. The National Survey on Drug Use and Health is going to have higher numbers, and those are more accurate, but they're still actually lower than reality. People don't necessarily tell you how much they drink and particularly what kinds of problems they have, so you sort of think of these as kind of minimums. But in terms of that survey, having five or more drinks in a day in the past month, which is a measure of what, you know, something like binge drinking or heavy occasion drinking, they found that 10% of those 12 to 17, 46% of those 18 to 25, which is, you know, not surprising maybe, but a high percentage, and 22% of those 26 and older did that. And those numbers, for particularly for the younger population, are higher than the U.S. average. For the 26 and older population, about the same as the U.S. average. So a little bit higher in the younger drinking. And what did stand out was the rates of alcohol dependence, and that's a very serious condition, suggesting that people have tolerance, withdrawal, changes in their routine activities because of alcohol, and potentially serious alcohol-related consequences. So you have to have at least three of those things to be classified as having alcohol dependence in the past year. And those rates for 18 to 25 and for 26 and older were significantly higher in Oregon than the U.S. average. So there does appear to be maybe a larger group of these more concentrated people with alcohol problems than in California or the U.S. in general. In terms of, so those are somewhat subjective measures. In terms of the more objective measures like mortality and traffic crash deaths, those tend to be more complete counts of things, though with the mortality rates, you don't always know for sure that it was alcohol that caused it or how exactly that happened. In terms of traffic crash deaths, Oregon is currently doing better than average. 317 traffic fatalities related to alcohol BAC over 0.08 in 2010. This is a significant improvement over recent years. In 2006, there were 478 such fatalities in the state. 478 fatalities, 148 of which are alcohol-related. So it's better on both, it's gotten much better on both fatalities and the proportion that were alcohol-related. In general, Oregon has done a little bit better than the U.S. average, but in recent years, particularly 2010, substantially better than the U.S. average, and I'm not sure why that is. You might know something about that, but that's a good sign. In terms of alcohol-related mortality, I took a look on the CDC Wonder site, which looks at the death certificate-based underlying cause of death in the population, age standardized in population rates to make it comparable across states. And For most things, the rates in Oregon were pretty similar, a little bit higher rates of suicide, and that may or may not be alcohol-related, but particularly higher rates of alcohol-dependence-related deaths, and those are things that are associated with chronic drinking of the type that might be involved in alcohol dependence over many years, typically. Could be alcohol poisoning that happens on a quicker basis, but generally chronic alcohol related. And those rates were about double the national average or double the rates in California. So coupled with the high rates found in the Drug Use and Health Survey, there is some concern about rates of alcohol dependent drinking.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
With the breakdown on this, was there a breakdown as to a gender? Were there more males and females, more females?
Yes. There's always more males than females for alcohol-related causes. And in this table, mortality rates, they are broken out by gender. So the rate, say, for alcohol dependence-related mortality was 2.1 per 100,000 for women and 5.8 for men. But both of those were double the comparable rates of the U.S. for women and men, respectively.
Thank you.
So it always differs. Men tend to drink about twice as much as women on average and have a lot more alcohol-related problems of every type. So taxes and revenues, a lot of this has been discussed. Looking at the markup formula, I saw about 113% markup on the producer price. That's in the ballpark of what was discussed earlier. Open state typical resale and wholesale markups, this I wish I knew exactly what these are. It's not really, there's not really good data describing what they are, but they're expected to be in the 60 to 70% range of both the wholesale and retail markup. So anything in excess of that could be considered a tax that's being put on spirits in the state. But what exactly that figure is hard to determine. So once Washington is no longer a control state, the markup percentage in Oregon will be the highest of any of the control states. Washington had a somewhat higher one. On the other end, New Hampshire has a markup of less than 50%, which is less than what would be expected in open markets. And that results in prices that are on average lower than other states, and they do that to bring in buyers from other states, which occurs, and they make quite a bit of money in that way. In terms of the markup formula, Oregon has this percentage markup on price. Other states don't necessarily do it only that way. Some have a combination of per gallon of spirits and markups. So those tend to have different effects across the range of price categories or potentially across alcohol content ranges. I don't think any of them actually focus on alcohol content. But they do have these combinations which result in different profiles across different brands and beverage types. And as we noted earlier, one of the important things about using the percentage markup as the tax or the revenue source is that it does go up as quality upgrading occurs and as inflation occurs. So it's sensitive to all of those things, whereas an excise tax that's only on a gallon of spirits, that only goes up if people drink more. So, when these other things change, those gallonage taxes won't change. And, so those are similar to the gallonage taxes on beer and wine that you have here. So that they not only sort of have a different effect across different types of products, whereas the percentage markup would kind of keep low-priced and high-priced products having relatively the same prices as each other, an excise tax would raise the price of the low-priced products more relative to the high price and encourage people to, shift towards higher-priced products. At least that would be the economic, it would incentivize them to do that, not necessarily make them do it. So that, it's those aspects of the markup or tax system are important to understand if you're thinking about what, different properties across time and across beverage types are. In terms of The other tax rate comparisons, I guess we saw a lot of this already as well. Open state spirits taxes range from about 4.6 cents per standard drink to 15 cents per standard drink in Alaska, which has the highest rate. The lowest rate is less than 2 cents per drink in the District of Columbia. And spirits taxes in general are higher than beer and wine taxes. They tend to be quite a bit higher, actually, on average and in almost every state. In terms of the beer taxes, I think we noted before that Oregon is quite low at, about less than 1 cent per standard drink. There are states that have lower taxes, particularly Missouri, the home of Budweiser, that's, you know, maybe half a cent, and a number of states that have significantly higher tax rates. I think Alaska is the highest open state for all the different beverages. And again, Oregon's wine tax rate is about 2.5 cents per drink, and that's lower than most states, higher than California and some other wine-producing states, but on average quite low. The average for open states in general is about 2.5 cents per drink of beer and 3 cents per drink of wine. So in general, those taxes are quite low, and you can compare that to the average of 4.6 for spirits, so it's maybe 50% more tax on spirits is the norm. In terms of revenues, provided three tables covering revenues for beer, wine, and spirits, and as was noted earlier, it's about $150 million a year. This is for 2008. I understand that's a little bit higher now. That's $63 per gallon of pure alcohol sold, or $48.55 per person over the age of 15 in the state. And comparable figures for other states, California in particular, is dramatically lower, about $6 per person. In fact, the total amount of revenue is only about 30% higher than Oregon, so they may actually be similar now, despite California's population being, I think, 10 times as much. Other states like Idaho raise a considerable amount, about $52 per gallon sold. Washington was raising $75 per gallon sold. That's expected to continue under the new system. The average for control states in general is about $50, and for open states, about $15 per gallon of alcohol. And some open states do raise more revenue because they have things like Kansas and Texas have an 8% tax on all on-premise sales. So it doesn't affect the price at the store, but they have these extra taxes that they put in for on-premise sales, or they might have license fees or other things like that. In terms of wine, as was noted, total revenue about $9 million a year. That's about $7 per gallon of alcohol in the form of wine and $3 per person. And that compares to a control state average of about $20 per gallon of pure alcohol and an open state average of about $10. So lower than both of those. And for beer, again, about $10 million in total revenue. That is about $3 or a little less than that per gallon of alcohol, and about $3 per person age 15 and older. And those compare to, for the gallons of ethanol, the control state average of about $6.61 and the open state average of about $9.81. So lower than both of those. And it's interesting to note that control states that make huge amounts of money on spirits tend to have lower taxes on beer and wine. And in fact, for beer, most control states have lower taxes than open states do. And I think part of the reason is they're not looking for revenue from wine and spirits so much because they already have it, from wine and beer so much because it's already there from spirits, so that those tax increases just don't come up in the way that they have in other states. So that covers those issues. And the two other questions that the committee wanted me to consider, and they were These are somewhat more difficult questions, I would say, but we can discuss those, but maybe also more important. What other state activities have been going on in relation to privatization? And there has been quite a lot of discussion in Pennsylvania and Virginia in particular. Also, many other states, North Carolina, Idaho, Utah and others, there's been some discussion, but not the kind of activity that we've seen, particularly in Virginia, where concrete plans came through to some extent, and in Pennsylvania, where some bills have been introduced to the legislature, though neither place has gone very far to this point. And the key issue always seems to be revenue. It's somewhat surprising that in times of tough budgets, some of the legislatures or governors are considering privatizing as a way to raise money. It's fairly difficult to raise money through privatizing, but there is the aspect of potentially bringing some of the money forward through selling off aspects of the control system. In many cases, you know, there are some assets like the warehouses or stores. In most states, the stores, even if they are government stores, are leased, so that, you know, there isn't really a huge amount of money there. But the licenses to sell alcohol in the future can potentially be sold now for use in the future, and that can bring some of the money forward. The difficulty with that is it's quite difficult to know how much you're actually going to get for those. They are certainly valuable, but if you take that money now, it's not going to be available in the future, and whether those auctions or other types of mechanisms for issuing those licenses are really going to get the most money that you could possibly get is really unknown. You don't know how many players they're going to be, who they're going to be, or how those auctions would work themselves out. And once they're done, if those licenses continue into the future, that's sort of a done deal in that way. And I think, yeah, and generally the main asset is that right to sell spirits. Privatization has come up in a number of states over time. I think I've heard the most about Pennsylvania, where it's apparently every 10 years or so come up, mostly through legislative discussion. And in my understanding, is at least, is in general, they just can't figure out how to maintain the revenues that that the control system brings in under a private system. And usually it ends there. And so certainly a lot of thinking is going into how that might be done in Pennsylvania and Virginia these days. And I think if you want to see what's being proposed, those discussions are available. But so far, it doesn't seem like they've been able to figure out exactly how that revenue would be replaced. I should note, too, that as mentioned earlier, health concerns should be of importance. Increases in availability and potentially decreases in price are likely to increase consumption, increase problematic consumption, and increase alcohol-related harms of all types. And those alcohol-related harms do have concrete costs that have to be covered. So there may be some savings in some ways, but there may also be both costs in human terms and monetary costs associated with increased consumption of alcohol.
Let me ask a question in that regard.
Sure.
Are the health concerns pretty uniform across the different beverage selections, or is it alcohol related or is it something else?
That's a good and difficult question. There may be some, in some studies seem to indicate that alcohol is generally a problem and it doesn't so much matter which kind it is. Most studies actually don't differentiate between the types of alcohol. Anything based on many of the surveys that are conducted, they just ask how many drinks somebody had. They don't even find out whether it was beer, wine, spirit. So those studies wouldn't be able to differentiate regardless. There is some reason to believe that spirits may be more potentially harmful than beer or wine. In particular, it has a high concentration, so high BACs are more achievable. For example, with a low-strength beer, like a light beer, it would be very difficult to reach, say, like a 0.20 or 0.30 BAC, whereas with spirits, you can reach these very high levels, and even up to 0.40, which is the level that's considered to be deadly to most people, which would be difficult to do with beer. Also, depending on how much somebody has eaten, they're going to achieve a higher BAC faster drinking spirits than they would with beer or wine that's diluted in water to some extent. Of course, it depends how they do it. You can mix your spirits drink to be the same strength as either beer or wine. One of our studies in California found that the typical mixed spirits drink in a bar is actually about the same strength as wine, about 13%. So people do, I think, often drink spirits at similar percentages of beer and wine, but the fact is they have control over it. So somebody that's a very heavy drinker or is becoming a heavier drinker can make their spirits drink stronger and stronger and stronger, and that might have effects on dependence and other outcomes that aren't really possible with beer or wine. So it's, yeah, there's some evidence that spirits may be more harmful, but it's not completely conclusive at this point.
Anything else as you're wrapping up?
Yeah, so, and I guess finally, you had asked about other state activities related to privatization. Wait a minute, what was the last one? Oh, other considerations in moving towards privatization, such as allowing beer and wine in liquor stores or spirit sales in supermarkets. And I think those have the same sort of issues that we've discussed earlier in terms of price and availability. The availability of spirits in control states like Oregon is fairly low. There's 8 spirits outlets per 100,000 residents. That's similar to other retail control states. Some of the ones with low density population have higher availability, but open states tend to have much more availability, 30, 40, 50 per 100,000. So, you know, it wouldn't be too hard to double the spirits availability, and that might have significant consequences. There's nothing really to say that one type of store is necessarily worse than another, particularly supermarkets. People have thought about whether that's the case. There's not a lot of research on it, but there's no clear evidence that they're worse or better than other types of places. And it would depend on whether control on prices was maintained as is now with the franchise stores, or if it was let go, that would potentially have a big effect as well. I guess some states have also considered privatizing their distribution systems. That's something that could come up, thinking that the private operator might be able to operate more efficiently. There's apparently no evidence that that's the case. Having one distributor of spirits seems to be pretty efficient if the state is keeping up on the latest practices and so forth, and there doesn't seem to be much room for savings there.
Okay. Questions, comments?
Very interesting. Okay. Interesting stuff.
We thank you for your work and for coming up. Thank you, Dr. Kerr. And now our final person, alcohol treatment provisions and funding, Karen Wheeler.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Tekenemer, Co-Chair Garrett, members of the committee. My name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm currently the Health System Transformation Project Director at the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm the former Alcohol and Drug Manager for the Addictions and Mental Health Division. I'm here to talk mostly about treatment, give you an overview of the system, and I'll also be sharing some slides with you about the budget for alcohol and drug services. And you have a handout of my slide deck coming around to you.
Thank you.
I listened a little bit before I came over, and I've heard that you've also you've already gotten the context of alcohol and the problems associated with misuse, heavy drinking. I will just say that, in summary of my second slide, that alcoholism is definitely a chronic disease. There are many people in Oregon who suffer from this disease, and there, fortunately, are a lot of people in Oregon who also are in recovery from this disease. We have a vibrant recovery community in this state, and actually, Portland was voted one of the top 10 cities for recovery, supporting recovery. Alcohol and drug abuse costs our state quite a lot of money in terms of health care costs, social costs, child welfare, criminal justice, and so on. One of the issues for all states, and we're no exception to that, is that we have a gap in terms of the treatment people can receive. We have about 18% of those who actually need treatment, who are adults, get treatment. So there are many people in Oregon who are unable to access treatment.
Yes.
Just on that point, is that because we have a lack of providers or because we aren't connecting the providers to the people who need the help?
Co-Chair Garrett, members of the committee, the treatment gap is primarily due to a lack of coverage, and people do not have insurance that will pay for treatment, and they cannot afford treatment. And as the prior gentleman referenced, the National Survey on Drug Use and Health actually asks a question to that effect. They ask people, how come you didn't get into treatment or you couldn't get in, and that is the top answer.
No insurance.
They can't afford it, and they don't have insurance. So it is my, especially my current role with the health authority, it's my hope that many more people will be able to access treatment because it will be covered in their benefit package, addiction treatment. So on slide two, you'll see just a summary of that, and actually the second column, those in need of public service, those numbers were derived from the National Survey on Drug Use and Health. And so for those over the age of 17, and this combines alcohol and drugs, this does not split out alcohol and drugs, but about 300,000 people are in need of some kind of assistance for alcohol and drug problems. So going on to slide four, we have, at the Health Authority and Addictions Mental Health Division, we have formed an epidemiological work group. This work group analyzes a lot of data, and some of the data sources that were referenced by the former gentleman are analyzed in Oregon by this work group. We were able to look at alcohol-related deaths, crime, and health consequences, just to name a few. As referenced, and this data that I have here is from 07, Oregon had the fifth highest rate of death from alcohol-induced disease in the country. So we were number five in that spot. And just as a context, in 07, there was a DUI violation every 20 minutes and a liquor law violation every 34 minutes in the state of Oregon in 2007. So moving to slide five, you also heard and were discussing the difference in terms of consumption for beer, wine, and distilled spirits. And you'll see the trend line from 1997 through 07. In 07, each person over the age of 21 in Oregon drank 623 drinks. That's for an
year?
Annual.
A year?
An annual, yes. And that's a standard drink. I'm not talking about, that total is for beer, wine, and distilled spirits.
Correct. Yeah.
So that is not just for distilled spirits. Slide number six. Alcohol misuse and dependence is not just a problem in Oregon. It's a worldwide problem, public health problem. Mm-hmm. You'll see it. We definitely like to think of it in terms of a public health problem at the health authority. And you will see that alcohol is identified as number 3 in the 10 leading risk factors for disease in developed countries. Tobacco being number 1 and blood pressure being number 2. And alcohol exacerbates other chronic illnesses. So on to the next slide. This pie graph gives you an illustration of the people who access treatment, addiction treatment, in Oregon, and their primary drug of choice when they access treatment. And so about 50% of individuals who do access treatment in the state of Oregon say that their primary drug of choice is alcohol. And that's followed by marijuana at 17%, and then amphetamine is the third primary drug of choice at about 14%. If you combine, however, heroin and other opiates, you get a fairly large number as well. So those are really the top four. But alcohol definitely outweighs everything else.
In going back to my earlier question, alcohol, as far as you're concerned, is generic. I mean, its volume of alcohol is not tight. It's not whether it's consumed as beer or wine or some form of still.
Co-Chair Kinnemer, that is correct. There are some differences in terms of culturally, age. You know, we see trends kind of come and go in terms of young people and what they are drinking. I'm not an expert on alcohol advertising, but I will say that people that work in the prevention realm are concerned about distilled spirits and the advertising that is definitely targeting young people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you could look at MTV or any of those other channels and see a bunch of young people having a blast and drinking distilled spirits. So, but the trends seem to come and go. The next slide, number 8, gets into the budget. And this chart just shows you treatment and prevention funding, all funding types that go into prevention, substance abuse prevention, and treatment. So treatment represents 88% of the addictions and mental health budget for alcohol and drug services, and prevention is 13.8 or 12%.
Representative Doherty.
I have a question. This kind of goes back to slide number 5, where in 1997 it was 500 and some odd drinks a year, and now it was 600 and something. Do you know if any of the increase in alcohol use and so on and drug use, there's been far less education in elementary schools and in communities and in schools about drug and alcohol due to budget cuts and that kind of thing? Is there any correlation, you think, between that? Or?
Co-Chair Kinnemer, Representative Doherty, I don't have a study or a fact that I could give you, but in general, there has been a reduction in capacity at the local level to provide prevention services. And when we look at, you know, that environment, along with the increased advertising promotion of alcohol, you know, one would think those two things don't mix very well. But I cannot say there's a direct correlation between the reduction in prevention and the increased use of alcohol.
Thank you.
So moving on to the next slide. Again, this is a budget slide. This slide gives you more of the detail around the types of revenue sources that go into the budget. And this is for treatment only. The bulk of the funding comes from federal sources, including Medicaid. There is a substance abuse prevention and treatment block grant that also represents a large portion of the budget for addiction treatment. The beer and wine tax represents the largest portion of the other fund category in that pie chart. I would add that alcohol taxes are considered local funds and can be used to match Medicaid. So that helps us draw down additional funding from the federal government. I would also add that in Oregon, the statutory framework for alcohol taxes provides a local match so that beer and wine taxes not only come to the Addictions and Mental Health Division to be allocated out to counties, those counties have to use their portion to fund alcohol and drug prevention and treatment services as well. And every biennium, we ask the counties what they're doing with those funds and how they're matching them with the funds that are allocated by the Addictions and Mental Health Division to provide that local framework for alcohol and drug prevention and treatment in their county. And the next slide just gives you a little bit of context about the prevention investments. The bulk of the revenue source for the Addictions and Mental Health Division to fund prevention is federal, and that comes from the Substance Abuse Prevention and Treatment Block Grant. So there's some beer and wine taxes that fund prevention, and some, the large portion is federal sources. We currently have a federal grant called the Strategic Prevention Framework Grant that is specifically focused on 18 to 25-year-olds and alcohol use. And so what we're doing with that grant is providing capacity in local communities to deliver treatment services, which include environmental policy type of approaches, as well as all kinds of prevention approaches to that age group specifically. And to my knowledge, that has not been a targeted age group before, and it's a very interesting project to me because obviously when you're 21, you're of age to drink. And so we're trying to target people who are excessively drinking that are of age to drink. The next slide gives you the breakdown of prevention funding and what goes into those to that funding source for to that budget. And I already talked about that. And then my last slide is basically the array of addiction services that are supported in the state of Oregon, which include outpatient residential detox services, a full range or constellation of addiction services for people to enter treatment, access recovery, remain in recovery. So it's a continuum in nature. And we also have educational services for people who get arrested for driving under the influence of intoxicants. These services are primarily funded through counties, tribes, and nonprofit organizations. And there are about 300 providers in the state of Oregon, addiction treatment providers. And every county has the capacity to deliver both prevention and treatment. And that is all I have. Okay. I'd be happy to answer any questions or thank be a resource.
You. Questions? Comments?
Thank you very much. This brings us, I think, about to the end of our meeting today. We appreciate everybody being here. Chris, maybe we should chat for a moment. I guess the September meeting, we're eager to have people bring suggestions. We were hoping that as people have thoughts about changes, we've entitled it modernization. I suppose it can be lots of different things to different people, but we're hoping that maybe people would talk with us and start working together in groups to see if there are things that we should do. You know, our concern was OLCC was starting to do the store within stores and letting different liquor dealers also sell beer and wine, and you know, where does this go? And it seemed to me, it seemed to us that it needed to be a policy discussion, and maybe there are ways in which people want to move one way or another, and this would be the forum for that discussion. If it were different financial times, we probably would have put a task force together to have done it. So that helps explain that as well. But there's nothing against personal initiative, and it's a grand opportunity. And what we'd like to do at our September session then is to hear different ideas, and then in our November when we would wrap it up on this topic and make some proposals that would be committee bills or perhaps other bills as well. Anything else for the good of the order? Okay, we thank you all for coming.
Wait, before you gavel out, I would like to congratulate our co-chair.
Oh, yes.
Mr. Garrett on the birth of his son.
Oh, thank you very much.
Hear, hear.
How old?
5 weeks.
Sleepless nights.
Indeed.
In Portland.
Yeah.
I haven't seen him doze off, so I'm not sure if he's doing his fair share.
He hasn't been watching long yet.
Okay. With that, we and Teresa, thank you for your good work in the interim. We appreciate you keeping us all up to speed, and we thank you all for coming. And with that, we are adjourned.